This book is still selling like hotcakes. It's been out for quite some time now, but it's still at the head of the New York Times bestseller list. It's called The Da Vinci Code. Now, I'll tell you the truth. I'm not a big consumer of thrillers or of these kind of intrigue novels. I'm just not. Tom Clancy never really appealed to me. But a lot of people are reading this book. Because it's more than just a thriller. It's more than just a spine tingler. Built upon a rather elaborate conspiracy theory, this book has a lot of people wondering whether or not what it says about the Bible, about Christianity, is true or not. We're going to try and clear up some of those answers, the questions raised by the Da Vinci Code, during this hour of Issues, Etc. Now, if you've read the book, or if you haven't read the book, if you're curious about what it says and whether or not what's in there is true, feel free to join our conversation, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for this first hour of Issues, Etc., James Patrick Holding is our guest. He's executive director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries based in Clare Kona, Florida, and he's author of an article entitled Indivincible, A Review and Critique of the Da Vinci Code. James, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks a lot, Todd. It's great to be with you.
For those who have not read this book or are unfamiliar with it, bring us up to speed about what the book is about, its premise, its plot.
Certainly. Well, I would classify the Da Vinci Code, as you said, as a somewhat technological slash historical thriller. And it begins with the murder of a curator in the Louvre Art Museum in Paris. And this curator is said to be part of a secret society that is the guardian of a collection of documents that will supposedly prove that Christianity was originally a sort of feminist goddess religion, and that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were husband and wife, and that Jesus intended for Mary Magdalene to be the head of the church, not Peter. And Brown links this up with popular conspiracy theories that the so-called Holy Grail is not the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper, but rather what is called a holy bloodline consisting of Jesus and Mary Magdalene's descendants. And most of the story thereafter, about 400 pages worth, involves the two lead characters running all over France and England trying to decipher all sorts of cryptographic puzzles left behind by the curator, letting them know where to find this stash of documents.
And does the story deliver in the end what it purports to kind of dangle in front of the reader, these documents, the refutation of Christianity?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and spoil the story then, if you don't mind. It doesn't deliver at all. And at the very end, the lead character is depicted in front of Mary Magdalene's grave and just waiting, and nothing is going to happen. We're not going to open up the grave. We're not going to find any documents, and we don't know whether there's anything in there that has any effect on Christianity. Brown just leaves it open.
Kind of like Geraldo Rivera standing in front of Al Capone's vault.
Well, they didn't even find a little bottle of it in this one.
Now, people are up in arms about this. Some people say, wow, this is some great stuff, and I always knew that those Christians were up to something no good. Others are saying, this is heresy. This is the kind of thing that Christians ought to really be concerned about. Others are saying, look, it's just a story. Where do you fall on the spectrum?
Well, frankly, some of the material and the claims in there, it's too, I'd say, too watery to even be considered heresy. I mean, it has so little substance to it. I can definitely say that Brown is offering some false information. And the difficulty is it comes in three parts. The first is that Whether people realize it or not, they're going to accept this as though he is reporting actual historical fact. And I logged on to Amazon Books this morning to check on some reviews to see what people were saying about it. And you find a lot of people who know that it's got false information in it. You find some people, like you say, who say, well, you shouldn't worry about it. But you also find a lot of comments like these. One person said, the research is correct. Another person said, it revealed more hidden truths about Christianity than most academic studies of history. Now, that's ironic. This person took a work of fiction as superseding works of academic history. You'll find people saying his research is impeccable, which is what the New York Daily News book review editor said. You'll find Publishers Weekly saying it's exhaustively researched. The second thing you'll find is that early on in the book, in a preface, Brown has a statement under a heading in bold letters, Fact, and it says, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. The third thing, and this for me is the most subtle and most dangerous, is that many of the statements that are controversial in this book are put into the mouth of a character named T-Bing, who is depicted as a reputable historian. Now, with these three things together, can you imagine any work of fiction today getting away with featuring a character who was portrayed as a trained anthropologist, spouting theories of racial inferiority, and prefaced by a statement that, quote, all descriptions of cultures, biology, sociology, and genetics in this novel are accurate?
It would be dismissed out of hand, I think.
I wouldn't think it would even find its way onto the bookshelves of Barnes & Noble.
All right. Does the book claim to be based in fact? We get a lot of this, you know, documentaries that don't claim to be factual. They claim to be based in fact. What about The Da Vinci Code?
Other than those statements that I mentioned where he put under the heading of fact claiming that all these things are accurate, the book itself doesn't clearly state this is fact all through, but it implies that it is fact, not only with that prefatory statement and by putting those statements in the mouths of a professional historian, but also by the fact that it gives a bibliography of reading within, referring to books by supposedly historians that verify these things. And Brown himself, on the television special that aired on Monday night on ABC, said that he was a believer in these theories. So he clearly takes this to be fact, at least a significant portion of it.
Now, someone who hasn't read the book will obviously be asking, why is it called The Da Vinci Code?
Okay. Well, Da Vinci is brought into the book. Now, Da Vinci, of course, was a Renaissance artist, man of all trades, shall we say. And his function is that he was supposedly part of a secret society, the same secret society that this curator is supposed to be within in our century. And he was, according to the novel, this curator's predecessor in guarding these secret documents that I've mentioned. And supposedly, Da Vinci left a lot of clues in his various works, his paintings and whatnot, showing that he really believed in this feminist goddess idea of Jesus. For example, it is alleged by Brown that the Last Supper, depicting Jesus and his disciples at the Last Supper, actually has Mary Magdalene sitting next to him, not the Apostle John, as the majority of art historians say. So this is all tied in with Da Vinci as a predecessor of this art curator guarding these documents.
So this was supposedly secret knowledge that Da Vinci possessed, and kind of in a sideways trail of clues. He leaves in his art clues for people who can figure it out that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, that they have a bloodline that survives in Europe to this day, that the Bible is a hoax?
That is correct. And Brown also hypothesizes that other major figures were involved with this secret society, including Isaac Newton.
And you said that the author of The Da Vinci Code buys these theories himself?
He claimed on the television special, "I Am a Believer in these things." He did not get into any specifics, but you can presume that if he put it in his book, it's a very good chance that he believed in it.
We're talking with James Patrick Holding, Executive Director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries, based in Clarcona, Florida. He's author of an article entitled "Indivincible: A Review and Critique of the Da Vinci Code." Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. If you read the book and are confused by some of the supposed facts that you found therein, feel free to give us a call. 1-800-730-2727. James, at the outset, are we dealing with a basic problem that goes beyond the Da Vinci Code, and that is kind of the modern tendency of people to fail to distinguish between fact and fiction?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the general tendency is if it's on television, it's true. If it's in print, it's true. No critical evaluation. And I run into this constantly, not just, of course, with this work, but with just about anything you can name. And the books that Dan Brown used as his basis, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and like the things that claim that this royal bloodline is what is really at issue, they're of the same sort. These works are not by certified scholars. They're not by people who know the Bible, who know the society or the languages of the Bible. They're by people who simply toss together some works, some encyclopedias, or some alleged secret documents, or whatever popular works they can assemble, and just create a hodgepodge of truth and fiction that can't be separated.
Let's talk specifically about some of the major problems of the novel, The Da Vinci Code, beginning with what Brown or how Brown depicts the Bible. Tell us about that.
Certainly. Well, here's the quote. The material concerning the Bible doesn't begin until about halfway through the book in chapter 55. First quote we have from, and this is put into the mouth of that historian, is, "The Bible did not arrive by facts from heaven. The Bible is the product of man, not of God. The Bible did not magically fall from the clouds. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times, and it has evolved through countless translations, additions, and revisions. History has never had a definitive version of the book." Now, let me begin by saying that this is such a vague and nonspecific claim that it's really hard to address anything in it directly. And so I just came up with some general points about this particular claim. Now, first of all, I don't know of any denomination at this time that believes the Bible arrived by facts from heaven or fell from the clouds, do you?
No.
No. Our ideas of how the Bible was inspired is much different than that. I mean, we believe that under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, men were guided to write the Bible. And that's simply a tendentious straw man that Brown puts up and puts in his historian's mouth. It's simply an excessive claim as to what is actually believed. Now, in terms of so-called countless translations, additions, and revisions, it would have been helpful if Brown had named even one example of some mistranslation or something that was added that shouldn't have been or something that was revised that shouldn't have been. He doesn't name a single issue here. But generally speaking, you've got answers to these things. In terms of translations, well, anytime you translate any ancient document in another language to our language, you're always going to have some issues. You're always going to have some questions, because there are always difficulties in translating from one language to another. I mean, you can just think of, for example, if in Spanish you might tell a joke that's based on a pun, and if it's based on a pun, it's not going to translate over to English. It's not going to make any sense. And so every ancient document is going to have an issue like this, but this doesn't cause us to press any panic buttons or say that we don't have a definitive version, and that's why we have scholars who learn these languages and look into these things. It's the same process in Greco-Roman studies with Latin. Even to this day, detailed studies continue on ancient languages like Latin and like ancient Greek and Hebrew, so they were always finding out more. But that's not to say that tomorrow we're going to discover that Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans is now a guide to sandal repair.
Well, I'm thinking of the training that I had as a parish pastor in the seminary and in the undergraduate work in the original languages of the scriptures. It was difficult work. Learning the language itself was a monumental task. And then putting my mind to the task of translating is never easy to do. But generally speaking, we're not dealing with mysterious and obscure writings here. We're dealing with pretty plain speech in languages that are well understood, and the grammar is very well understood even by us moderns.
Certainly, and I think it's no coincidence that the two biblical languages, Hebrew and Greek, are still spoken today. I mean, they have evolved, certainly, but they are still around. And I certainly would think that you would find no evidence that there's any difficulty, as Brown intimates here, with so-called countless translations.
All right, then what about his contention that the Bible is basically kind of the product of men, and this is playing into very popular notions about the Bible, that it's just more kind of the product of the believing community rather than divine revelation?
Again, since he doesn't get into a lot of specifics as to how he believes this is so, it's hard to address anything in particular. But the general attitude that we see is that, well, this is just a history that men have been able to tamper with through the ages. The evil church got its hands on it and changed things around. Jesus used to be just a nice guy, and they later added in this idea that he was divine and that he was the Son of God. If you're going to say something like this, you should have some evidence. You should have, like, a copy of a gospel, like a gospel of Matthew, missing all of these claims by Jesus that he was the Son of Man or the Son of God or what have you. But this is exactly what they don't have. And so what you have to resort to is a conspiracy theory that, well, we don't have any evidence, but that's because all the evidence was destroyed.
This is kind of the classic answering all arguments of most conspiracy theories. A lack of evidence becomes the strongest piece of evidence.
Yes, and you have no way to win because the theory becomes unfalsifiable.
All right, what about his notion of Jesus Christ? How does he try and portray Jesus himself and then the development or the supposed development of this notion that Jesus is God.
Well, what few details he offers on this, he seems to posit that Jesus, again, was married to Mary Magdalene, that he had some sort of a feminist goddess-worshipping sort of organization going. He doesn't go into much depth in that, but what he ends up saying is that the current idea that Christianity has of Jesus as the Son of God, as divine, was invented by Constantine, who is the great villain in these conspiracy theories. He is always the great villain. And supposedly where this all occurred is the Council of Nicaea. And the Council of Nicaea, too, is the usual target for this for these conspiracy theories. This is who changed it. Now, here's a particular quote from that historian in that book. "Jesus Christ was a historical figure of staggering influence, perhaps the most enigmatic and inspirational leader the world has ever seen. His life was recorded by thousands, note that number, thousands of followers across the land. More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them." And that's an interesting point there, among them. That's the only ones that were chosen for inclusion. And then he ends up saying, "The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman emperor Constantine the Great."
What's the problem with that statement?
There's tons of problems in this statement. First of all, he's speaking of thousands of followers recording Jesus' life. In his own time, Jesus was not really a staggering influence. Now, that seems counterintuitive to us because he is our Savior. But in his time, by the people who controlled mass media of the day, so to speak, he was not considered that important. It was only when his followers started making noise that he was considered important. Now, a major problem here is thousands of followers across the land. Not only is that contradicted by what I just said about Jesus not being considered that important within his own lifetime, but the fact is that 90 to 95% of people in the ancient world were illiterate. Now, how are these thousands of followers going to write all these Gospels? How are they going to be recording his life if they can't even read and write? This shows a very basic ignorance of the ancient world by Brown. Now, 80 Gospels. Unfortunately, Brown only decides to name two of these 80 and do any details on them, and we can talk about those. But the process of forming the canon was in process long before Constantine. And this was something that was being put together by the church starting as early as the first century. It's very likely that the Apostle Paul himself was the one who first started collecting documents, because it was normal for a man of letters in that time to collect his own letters near the end of his life and then publish them all together. I think a better source for this is a biblical scholar named Robert Grant, who wrote in this book, The Formation of the New Testament. He said, "The New Testament canon was not the product of official assemblies or even of the studies of a few theologians. It reflects and expresses the ideal self-understanding of a whole religious movement, which, in spite of temporal, geographical, and even ideological differences, could finally be united in accepting these 27 diverse documents as expressing the meaning of God's revelation in Jesus Christ and to his church." If you're going to say anyone assembled the canon, it was the church itself. Constantine was a latecomer on the scene as far as this went.
And there was a standard by which the church judged the canonicity of its writings, and it was, are they apostolic?
Absolutely.
Do they come from the pen of Paul genuinely, or of Peter, the other apostles, or, in the case of some of the Gospels, do they have an apostolic foundation, that in being, say, Mark is Peter's gospel, those kind of things?
Absolutely, and that makes perfect sense, of course, because if you're going to collect writings of Martin Luther King, who are you going to collect them from? You're going to collect them from people who knew him personally. You're not going to collect them from somebody who lived 150 years later who thought he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan or what have you. You know, you're not going to accept something that's entirely different from those who are closest to the person.
Okay, so he's got this picture of the Council of Nicaea, 325, mm-hmm. where Constantine not only kind of collates the Bible, but also radically reorients the teaching of the church. What's the story, according to Brown in the Da Vinci Code?
Well, Brown doesn't, as usual, does not give a lot of specifics, but the main thing he says happened there was that Jesus was decided to be the Son of God. And what I'm going to call up the part where I discuss this. The actual issue at the Council of Nicaea was with a presbyter named Arius, A-R-I-U-S. And the view he held is that Jesus was not the eternal Son of God, did not exist eternally, but was created at some point in time. Now, today, the people who follow this are called Jehovah's Witnesses. We still have Arianism with us, just not under the same name. And it, what happens, though, is that Brown does not even get this right. Here is how his character, again, his historian, describes it. At the Council of Nicaea, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon, such as the date of Easter, but mainly the divinity of Jesus. Until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. Now, this is not even a correct representation of what Arius was holding, because Arius did believe that Jesus was divine, just not divine by nature, that he had to be created in ages past, not that he was eternal. And so it's not so much that Jesus was not to be a mortal or just a great or powerful man by the heretics. And there's an interesting aside to this as well. Constantine, the fellow they blame this on, was sympathetic to Arius. So Brown is way off even in knowing whose side he was on.
And as to this supposedly close vote to declare Jesus divine?
Well, if he speaks of a close vote in there, but according to the sources I find, the vote was something like 298-2. I don't think if the St. Louis Rams lost by that score, anyone would call it close, do you?
We're talking with James Patrick Holding. He's executive director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries based in Florida. He's authored an article titled Indivincible, a review and critique of the Da Vinci Code. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so at 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. There is a website, by the way, for Tectonics Apologetics Ministries. It's tectonics.org. I'll spell it for you. It's tektonics.org, tektonics, tectonics.org. With a minute before we go to this break, James, let me see if I've got the whole story clear, at least up to this point.
Okay.
Brown is supposing that Christianity began really as a feminist goddess religion, deeded by Jesus at his death to his wife, Mary Magdalene. They had kids, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
After the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene flees away to Europe, where she starts a royal bloodline with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
This is a secret that is suppressed, essentially, by Constantine at 325 at the Nicene Council, where Jesus is declared to be divine. Mary Magdalene is expunged from Christian worship. It becomes a worship of Jesus rather than that. They put the Bible together in order to bolster their claims, and the conspiracy is held firm for lo these 1,700 years.
Yes, as a whole, he implies most of that rather than stating it directly, and I think he would see the suppression of beginning even before Constantine, but as a whole, that would be correct.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with James Patrick Holding. We're talking about the best-selling novel, The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. You know what, folks? Dan Brown says he's a Christian. In spite of everything that he writes in his book, in spite of the fact that on Monday night on ABC you heard him say that he buys his own theories about Christianity in the Bible, he does claim to be a Christian. When we come back, I've got a quote from an interview with him in answer to that question, and we'll get the reaction of our guest, James Patrick Holding, to what Brown says about his own faith. Now, if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call during this break. It's a great time to call, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back with more conversation on the Da Vinci Code.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you looking for a reliable, Christ-centered guide for your daily devotional life? Instead of spending 40 days concentrating on your purpose with Rick Warren, why not spend those days meditating on God's mercy with Johann Gerhardt? Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is called Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. It's translated by Pastor Matt Harrison. You can order Meditations on Divine Mercy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find more information on our Issues Etc. book of the month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear how constant prayer changed a 5-year-old girl in India. Swati's life from birth to preschool was full of tragedy. Her father burned her mother to death, and she lived with relatives who could barely feed her. Then her uncle brought her to the Mukti home in the Indian city of Mumbai. Mukti's Mumbai home is parented by a Christian couple who prays over each girl in their care. Swati, though, had severe behavioral problems and was constantly sick. Her house parents got so tired that they almost returned her to a grandmother until once again they prayed and shared Christ's love with her. Swati accepted Jesus and her behavior improved. Pray that Swati and other girls in Mukti's Mumbai home will grow in Christ's love. Get inspired to pray with a free copy of Swati's remarkable story. Call 1-800-268-0461. 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Have the fall leaves been colorful where you live? In our backyard, we have what the botanists call a Euonymus elatus compactus. For us commoners, a burning bush. True to its name, its leaves have turned a brilliant red. The popular name comes from Exodus 3. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in flames of fire from within a bush. God said, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." A bush. And so much else we speed by every day. Wherever you look, nature offers countless opportunities to stand in awe at the magnificence of God's creation. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote, "Earth is crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God, and only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries." If you've only been plucking away at your schedule, you still have many opportunities for holy, marveling moments. Take a look, for example, at old Euonymus elatus compactus when it's bare, and you'll see that its branches are square, not round. So many opportunities to marvel. Yeah, but what do? We rush on to the next meeting. We watch the next TV show.
Holy Cross Lutheran Church in St. Louis is the AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week. Holy Cross is a historic Lutheran community bringing the gospel to the 21st century. On Sunday, November 9th, the congregation of Holy Cross will celebrate 145 years of Christ-centered ministry with a service of praise and thanksgiving. The service is at 10 a.m. The church is located at 2650 Miami Street in South St. Louis. The members of Holy Cross are inviting all to participate in this joyous celebration.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with James Patrick Holding about the Da Vinci Code. You know, instead of reading the Da Vinci Code, you know what you ought to read? You ought to read our Issues Etc. book of the month. It's called Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. It is translated, this little treasury of devotional prayers, translated by our regular guest here on Issues Etc., Pastor Matt Harrison. Meditations on Divine Mercy. Now, the book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or if you'd like to browse before you buy, find out something about the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. It's Meditations on Divine Mercy. As we talk about the Da Vinci Code, feel free to join us with a question or a comment. James Patrick Holding is our guest, Executive Director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries, based in Florida. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We also have a live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we move on with some of the content here, James, I came across an interview with Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, and he was asked in this interview, "Are you a Christian?" I'll give you his answer. I'd like your reaction. He says, "I am, although perhaps not in the most traditional sense of the word. If you ask three people what it means to be a Christian, you'll get three different answers. Faith is a continuum, and we each fall on that line where we may. By attempting to rigidly classify ethereal concepts like faith, we end up debating semantics to the point where we entirely miss the obvious, that is, that we're all trying to decipher life's big mysteries and reach following our own path of enlightenment. I consider myself a student of many religions. The more I learn, the more questions I have. For me, the spiritual quest will be a lifelong work in progress. Your response?
Well, that's one of the longest non-answers I've ever heard, Todd. That one, I think it runs back to something that C.S. Lewis said some time ago, is that the word Christian has come to have the same problem as the word gentleman did some years ago. It used to be that a gentleman specifically referred to some wealthy landowner, and then as more people wanted the title, it gradually came to lose its meaning. The sort of definition that Brown is, or rather non-definition that he is offering, would admit practically anyone people who don't even know who Jesus Christ is, and would end up believing just about anything about him. And if we're going to open it up that much, then we've lost all meaning to the term. And we have a very specific historical meaning associated with the word Christian. The Christians were first called by that name in the book of Acts as meaning little Christ, and it means they were imitators of Christ and believers in Christ. And if you do not accept that within its historical contextual meaning, then you may as well throw out your dictionary for the meanings of words.
One of the dangers, it seems, to the Da Vinci Code is that it contains just enough information, we might call it misinformation, just enough tidbits and name dropping, like the Dead Sea Scrolls and certain pseudepigraphal gospels, that people get the impression, or of course New York Daily News obviously must have gotten this impression, that this is the product of exhaustive research.
Correct.
What is the truth? Because there are pseudepigrapha, there are other gospels that were in circulation in the first couple centuries of Christianity. What should we really do with these documents?
All right, well, let's talk about a couple of different things. Let's start with those Dead Sea Scrolls, because those are very important, and those are often the subject of conspiracy theories. His historian has this statement: "Fortunately for historians, some of the Gospels that Constantine attempted to eradicate managed to survive. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 1950s hidden in a cave near Qumran in the Judean desert." He's got the location correct, at least. The rest of it is completely in error. The first thing is that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, not in the 1950s. The second thing is that they did not contain any Gospels. If you read that statement, it sounds like he's saying there are Gospels in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are no Gospels in there. All they are, for the most part, is copies of the Old Testament, the Jewish books of the Bible, and internal documents for the Qumran community for them to live their lives. And they're sort of apocalyptic documents, might say. They're equivalents to, like, our Book of Revelation. Yeah, there have been a couple of ideas that there are, like, tiny scraps of the Book of Mark, for example, in there. But there are no other Gospels in there. There are no heretical Gospels. There are no documents related to Christianity in the Dead Sea Scrolls at all. So that's the first thing. Now, in terms of the other Gospels that Brown tries to present as an alternate, he only names two specifically in his work. And one of these is the Gospel of Philip. And his historian says this is a good place to start, quote. And one of the quotes that he focuses on in there is one in which Jesus is said to kiss Mary Magdalene on the mouth. Now, mouth is just an insertion. They're not sure because there's apparently a hole in the text right there. But that's what their guess is. It says on the mouth. And this is said to point out that Mary was much closer to Jesus, and the specific word in there supposedly is companion. And Brown even makes a tremendous error in here, because he has his historian claim that this word in Aramaic means a wife. Well, that's a little hard to believe, because the Gospel of Philip is written in Greek. So you can hardly know what the Aramaic word in there is supposed to be, or that it means that Mary was Jesus' spouse. In practical terms, sober scholars date the Gospel of Philip to the 3rd century. We're talking about 200 years after Jesus lived. And there's no way that Philip, the apostle in Acts, is going to be writing this Gospel. Even the most disbelieving scholars will date our canonical Gospels to no later than 80 to 100 A.D., about 50 to 70 years after the life of Jesus. On the other hand, the collection of documents where the Gospel of Philip was found, which is the Nag Hammadi documents, was written no earlier than 350 A.D. by the textual evidence that we have. In addition, the Gospel of Philip is a Gnostic text. Now, the Gnostics were somewhat like the mystics of the day, and they would have found no home in Jewish Palestine of Jesus' day. If Jesus had been going around Palestine teaching Gnosticism, he would have been laughed at. He would have been driven out of Judea as ridiculous. The people of Judea would not, and Galilee would have had no patience with a Gnostic Jesus. The second document that Brown appeals to is called the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, not surprisingly. And his historian says that, quote, modern historians have already explored this issue, and it too treats Mary as a companion. It shows Peter getting upset after Jesus gives Mary special instructions to run the church after his crucifixion. And so what his historian goes on to say is, quote, Jesus was the original feminist. He intended for the future of his church to be in the hands of Mary Magdalene. The Gospel of Mary Magdalene is no better off than Philip in this case. It's a Gnostic document also, so you're not going to have any Palestinian Jew accepting this or being, you know, having any reality in this. The few fragments we have of it date to the 3rd century, and most scholars will date it no earlier than 180 to 200 AD. We're still talking about 150 years or more away from the time of Jesus. So these documents that he appeals to, the only ones he names specifically, are simply of no worth, and you will not find any scholarship supporting his idea that these represent the original Jesus in any sense. It's as though you were saying a gospel that depicts Jesus opening a refrigerator and taking out a burrito and putting it in the microwave is somehow a genuine document of the first century. There are simply too many anachronisms. It's not going to work.
I'm intrigued by the way he describes historians have looked into this. He doesn't say historians have found them to be genuine, but he does feel free to kind of mention historians as though maybe they might have looked into it and found it to be genuine.
Absolutely. But when you check out the list of the books that his historian recommends, you find some problems. Now, he only names 4 books in particular. One of those is Holy Blood and Holy Grail by Bajan and Lee. And this is, as I noted earlier, one of these conspiracy theory books that believes in the Holy Bloodline. And but you find that these writers are not biblical scholars. The only credential I could find on Bajan is that he has a degree in psychology. And I couldn't find any credentials for Lee other than that he was a lecturer of some sort. Another book recommended is The Templar Revelation by Pickett and Prince. And when I checked this one out, they're listed as, quote, writers, researchers, and lecturers on the paranormal, the occult, and the historical and religious mysteries. Consider that one of their other titles is The Stargate Conspiracy, The Truth About Extraterrestrial Life and the Mysteries of Ancient Egypt. Another one of their books is called The Mammoth Book of UFOs. Now, obviously, we're not dealing with people who publish with Yale University Press or Harvard University Press. We're dealing with people who are publishing in non-academic areas, and they're hardly to be trusted in these areas. 2 of the books he recommends, one is titled The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, and the other is called The Goddess and the Gospels, is authored by Margaret Starbird. And it is her books are published by a press called Bear & Company, which is, again, hardly Harvard University Press. She is the only one I could find of this group that has any kind of credentials. It says on her books that she has a master's degree and went to Vanderbilt Divinity School. But it's not clear to me what that master's degree is in and whether any of her material went by peer review. And I very much doubt that as she turned in her books to her professors at Vanderbilt that it would get any kind of passing grade.
James Patrick Holding is our guest. We're talking about the best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code and the Claims Therein. It's by Dan Brown. James Patrick Holding is Executive Director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries based in Florida. He's written a review and a critique of The Da Vinci Code called Indivincible, a review and critique of The Da Vinci Code. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or feel free to use our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So to summarize here, we basically have someone appealing, Brown is appealing to very late documents viewed by all scholarship, believing and unbelieving scholarship, to be pseudepigraphal, that is false writings, and he is appealing to them as though they could be used to supersede the genuine Gospels of the New Testament.
That's correct. Now, you will find, you know, a scholar here and there who will take some odd position about one of these documents, but this is by far and away minority positions that he is advocating. If I may recommend a particular book here, it's called Hidden Gospels by Philip Jenkins. And Philip Jenkins is a secular scholar who is in historical and religious studies at Penn State University. And he does a very careful analysis of these movements and these people who want to promote various documents like these. And you'll occasionally find them promoting one in particular, saying, well, maybe this one just happened to be early. But they, in order to reach these conclusions, they will have to come up with so many different excuses, shall we say, like, well, maybe there were extra copies destroyed or what have you, in order to date it early, that it ends up being a contrivance. It's simply not acceptable, and it's certainly not the sort of thing that they would accept for us to defend the canonical Gospels if we tried.
What about someone who says, look, but isn't it true that 3rd, 4th century Christianity was in the habit of, well, borrowing pagan symbolism, and wouldn't that argue that there was more similarity originally in Christianity between paganism and Christianity than we're given to believe?
Well, there's a couple of points to be answered about this. Now, first of all, it is true that certain symbols and such were borrowed, but that is not exactly meaning what most people will think it is. In this particular time, art was imitative, and when religions were clashing with one another, it was kind of like what you'd call the Cola Wars. They were just trying to one-up with each other. And I'll give you an example here, and one of my favorites is the pagan deity called Mithra. And the Mithraic people would have a depiction of their hero on the back of a bull killing it. And to compete with this, sort of like one-up them, the church did a similar scene with Samson killing a lion. Now, are you going to say that they borrowed the story of Samson from Mithra? No, you're not going to say that. They're just doing a little competition, like saying, we're better. You can ignore Mithra. Samson's the real hero here. And the important point to remember is that this is a borrowing of art. This is not a borrowing of ideology. This is not a borrowing of concepts. This is something entirely different than what people who claim that Christianity borrowed things are saying. It is not involved borrowing any particular beliefs.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-730-2727. Ann is calling. Ann, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, good afternoon. I have not read the book. My sister has, and I have it in front of me. My husband's reading it. But I kind of wanted to know about the part, the Da Vinci part of it. Is this treatment of his scholarship as far as this subject, is that the fictitious part of the story, or is that based on some facts?
This is not an area of my expertise, but I did look into a few things about this. I think I mentioned earlier about the Last Supper painting saying that Mary Magdalene was in there. On the television special, they could find only one art historian who stood behind the idea that this was a woman depicted there. Another art historian they interviewed said, no, there's no way that's a woman. And another art historian said the same thing on the Today Show as well. The ones who doubted said, well, you know, this is how the Apostle John was often depicted, sort of as a very young man who looks sort of like a woman to our views. As far as some of these other things, such as Da Vinci being part of a conspiratorial society, that, too, I found no justification for. This society that he was allegedly part of, the Priory of Sion, was actually more of an invention in modern times, and they made up basically a genealogy for themselves, including all these people. And I found very little to back up the idea. There were some other pieces of trivia that I did not include in the article since that was not my focus, such as the claim that Da Vinci had many commissions from the Vatican. From what the sources I found, he really had only one, and that one didn't really turn out too well. So from what I can see so far, there's very little indication that his comments about Da Vinci are overall true. Another one in particular that strikes me is that he claimed that the Mona Lisa was somehow an androgynous picture. It is known, according to one art historian, that an actual woman did pose for that, the Madonna Lisa. So he is definitely not in line with what art historians, the majority of art historians, are going to say.
I mean, this comes from a lay perspective when it comes in terms of art, but I have been there and looked with my own eyes at the Last Supper painting. And number one, it is so deteriorated, it would be impossible for anyone today to say, oh, you know, Da Vinci was really trying to depict a woman there, because he kind of looks like a woman with the long hair and all. It's a very crumbling painting. That's, you know, just from the lay perspective.
Well, the apostles have long hair in the picture, too, and they have beards, too. So what does that tell you? I did find that Brown he gets very simple facts wrong. One of his reports, for example, is that the glass pyramid in front of the Louvre Art Museum is composed of 666 panes of glass. And I got onto a website for the Louvre, and it said that it actually had 673 panes of glass. So he's a little fast and loose with the facts, even outside of the religious context.
All right. To this issue of Jesus being a married man, Brown makes a very peculiar argument for this. It amounts to saying something like, well, it would have been unheard of in first century Palestine for a man of Jesus' age to be unmarried. It would have brought him scorn and ridicule from the public. Therefore, he must have been married.
Yes, yes.
How do you respond to this?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first is obviously that's simply an argument from silence. You just don't say, well, it doesn't say anything, so we can affirm it. And more to the point, now, it's hard to say where he gets this information from. He doesn't, as usual, list any kind of source for this. But most of the time when people make this kind of claim, they appeal to documents written by the rabbis some several hundred years after the time of Jesus, which declared celibacy immoral or something that shouldn't be done. But there's two problems with using the rabbinic literature like this. The first is, as the historian E.P. Sanders notes, and he's a specialist on the rabbinic literature, you can't always be sure that what they're offering is common practice. It may be just something that it was an ideal that they never were able to follow. And in the case of things having to do with not being married, that's pretty much clear. Even in the rabbinic literature, it's said that postponement of marriage was allowed for students of the law so that they could concentrate on their studies. And in Jesus' time, many hundreds of years before these documents, it's obvious that we have many people who did not agree with the idea that you had to be married. Think particularly of the Essenes, the people who were the possessors of the Dead Sea Scrolls that Brown relies on. They apparently endorsed celibacy. The Jewish writer Philo discusses a sect of Jewish men and women called the Therapeutae, who were celibate because of their studies in the pursuit of wisdom and the holy life. And then even in Jewish history, you have many prophetic figures who were either allowed or expected to be celibate. You think of the prophet Jeremiah, John the Baptist, and possibly Elijah as well. Closer to Jesus' time, we had a wilderness prophet named Bannus, who is mentioned in Josephus. And even in the 2nd century A.D., we had a Galilean rabbi named Pinhas ben Yair, who taught that abstinence was essential to the reception of prophetic wisdom. And so, and think of this as well. Moses, you know, was depicted as a celibate prophet in some traditions. Even though he'd gotten married, at certain points he was depicted as a great primordial prophet, portrayed as celibate. So it's obvious that wherever Brown is getting this, it is simply not backed up by the facts. It is not true that Jesus had to be married, that it would have been made infinitely more sense, as his historian puts it, to say that had to be married. And there's certainly nothing that said that the times virtually forbid a Jewish man to be unmarried. That's simply not true.
Now, in the last few minutes of our conversation here, James, let's talk a little bit about why this book is so popular and why some even take its claims seriously.
Well, I used to work as a librarian, and people who choose books like this are usually looking for just a quick summer read or what have you. And I imagine a few people picked this up, found it exciting, and also found the idea of hidden knowledge, so to speak, or hidden gospels somehow tempting. Philip Jenkins talks about this in his book, and he says, you know, that the temptation of hidden documents, of secret documents uncovered, of there being a conspiracy, it's somewhat of a psychological prop for people. They get this idea, oh, I'm in on this secret, you know, and things are being covered up, and I know better. You know, I have a special insight. I think there's something of the temptation in that with the Da Vinci Code, because it offers you a view into something like this, something that no one else knows. And I think that's the sort of comment we see in that one particular I quoted, that it tells more about hidden truths about Christianity than most academic studies. The idea being expressed there is, well, academic studies are hiding things from us. It's all some plot to keep things hidden from us and keep us from being who we should be. Very much here an appeal to the individual, I'd say, as well, and to our egos, shall we say.
And your thoughts on the failure of some to be able to distinguish between the fiction of this book and fact?
Well, I believe that we are simply not taught the difference in our schools, and I think that's demonstrated daily, and our children are not taught the difference between the two. Anything that is more convenient or more accepted tends to be taught as true, or truth is taught to be irrelevant in many cases. I think that extended quote you gave from Brown illustrates that perfectly. And he spoke of being interested in many religions, and in spite of the fact that they obviously couldn't all be true. It's either one is true or none of them are, because they all contain contradictory claims. But the attitude is, let's just go with everything we can, and so we don't offend anybody, is part of the process.
James Patrick Holding, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. I appreciate it being on.
James Patrick Holding is Executive Director of Tectonics Apologetics Ministries, based in Florida. He has written an article titled Indivincible, a review and critique of the Da Vinci Code. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of this broadcast, or if you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of Our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to donate monthly to Issues Etc. by becoming a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Now, I mentioned the article written by our guest in this hour, Indivincible, a review and critique of the Da Vinci Code. You can read that article at the website for Tectonics Apologetics Ministries. That's tectonics.org, tectonics.org. I was once asked by a listener, what's wrong with these conspiracy theories? Can someone hold to these conspiracy theories without it doing damage to their faith? Now, my answer was, well, I guess in theory you could hold to one of these theories without it damaging your faith, but witness what it is just this one kooky conspiracy theory requires of you. Not only that you suspend disbelief, not only that you suspend, well, in some cases, basic logic, not only that you allow the author of the book, Dan Brown, to draw you into a world that is neither proven or for which there exists no real evidence. Not only that you believe half-truths and hints and notions and speculation, how much does a conspiracy theory like the one put forward in the Da Vinci Code require of you? It requires that you give up a lot. What is the truth? The truth simply lays before you without hints, without any elaborate webs of conspiracy, who Jesus Christ really is. He is God, He is man, He is our Savior from sin. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.